Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Derek Bowman, Feldman & Feldman in Houston. He's an appellate lawyer there. Derek, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Really appreciate you having me here.
Sure. And for our guest, if you could just kind of give a little bit about your background, kind of maybe how you got into law and how you got to your career path that you're in today.
Oh boy, we could probably spend the podcast on that, but I won't. I'll try to keep it short. I do have the story that I have in the can that I bore many people with at parties, but I actually quite accidentally stumbled into law. And the short version, I just have to tell it because it's your fault because you brought it up.
Please.
But I tell this story. I was working at a job. I won't mention the employer, but it was a job where, no joke, I would just kind of go in and turn off my brain in order to survive the day. And I had a boss who was amazing. I will name him. His name is Jesus Gonzalez. And he, when I was in young and in my 20s, he was on a pressure campaign where he said, Derek, you're wasting your life. You need to figure out what you're going to do with it. So one day as a joke, and it was supposed to be taken as a joke where everybody laughed, I said, how do you think I'd be as a lawyer? And everybody I said this joke to didn't laugh and said, I think you'd be good at it. You should explore it. So that's kind of what set me on my path. Just real quickly, when in law school, I thought I'd be a transactions attorney. And then I took my first transaction class and was quickly like, nope, not going to be a transaction attorney. But by mere coincidence, I had signed up for an appellate class that I thought I would hate and found out that semester that I absolutely loved. And so from that moment on, it became my goal to become an appellate lawyer. And then just very briefly, I spent some time as a briefing attorney. Last year, they had a full set of briefing attorneys at the first court of appeals. The last year that all nine judges had one. So I was very, very fortunate to get that. And that kind of marked my career and allowed me to become an appellate specialist.
You clerked for Justice Higley, is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. I clerked for her for 1 year and then once went into private practice. And then after some time, I went back to the court and was a staff attorney also for Justice Higley and spent many years with her. She was an amazing woman and a fantastic judge.
And we, of course, can't leave out that you were part of the legendary 2005 class from the University of Houston Law Center.
Can't leave that out.
A lot of great lawyers and podcast co-hosts.
I see the connection now. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Now you know why I got invited. He doesn't care about AI. He's just trying to get all
right. Yeah, it's totally unrelated. I just had to plug our law school class. Anyway, thanks for coming on today. I hope you have a great week.
Exactly.
So you were a staff attorney after being a briefing attorney, and then you went to the city attorney's office?
Went to the city of Houston for a brief stint. Honestly, loved it there. It was a great group of people. It was really interesting work to have. Then ended up not long after that making the jump to where I am at Feldman & Feldman. I am the appellate attorney, but there was another guy here for a while.
What kind of work does Feldman & Feldman do?
Yeah, it's the number of things where I get handed something where I didn't even really know that was an area of law. And then the instructions are figure this out. And I'm like, oh, good. It's civil. But just, I mean, we do actually do a fair amount of governmental law, which is part of how I found the firm. But just the number of things that we take on, it's just something new every time. And it often surprises me.
Did you do appellate work at the city of Houston?
I did. They had a small appellate group and I was a part of that group. And I am kind of like labeled as like the appellate guy here, but very good chunk of what I do is civil litigation.
It's good to be labeled the appellate guy.
That was my only label. It's really my complaint. Yeah, I mean, it's great. I really do get a lot of different things. I mean, you guys probably know, this may sound corny, but I am at my happiest when I'm writing a brief in my legal career. But when I'm writing that brief and that's all I'm doing and I can block out all the other things that I'm supposed to be doing and just sitting there writing a brief, I'm a happy man, just a happy man.
I totally get it. A friend of mine recently referred to it as falling down the writing hole. And it's a good place to be.
Exactly. I love it. I'd stay there if I could, but I don't have enough briefs to write. So
The fact that they do some government-related law over there, was that the natural fit between your prior time working in the government and moving into Feldman and Feldman?
It was. I mean, it was also that they really were looking for someone who had appellate experience. And so I kind of had that twofer attraction. Is like I had a fair amount of governmental, well, a fair amount of governmental law under my belt, and then also board certified in appellate law. So, and they were looking for that as well. And I think if anybody knows the name Feldman and Feldman, they know Dave Feldman was the city attorney for a while. And so that was part of the connection that brought me in. I didn't know him before I came here, but those two worlds intersect, right? Mm-hmm. So,
well, let's kind of back up a little bit. We're going to talk about AI, but obviously you've kind of had a longstanding interest in technology and AI. Where did that come from, or how did that start?
Well, I've always had a longstanding interest in technology and computers. It's honestly, my knowledge of AI is more limited, but computers more broadly. Mm-hmm. Was if you ask anyone that knew me in high school before I graduated, if you'd asked anybody that knew me back then, what is Derek going to study in college? Everybody, without hesitating, said computer science. That's obviously where he's heading. And if you'd asked me that, I would have given you the same answer. And then in high school, my senior year, I can't explain why, I just got a wild hair and took a theater class and loved it. And then in college said, you know what, I'll be a theater major, including me, so it surprised everyone. And so, and I continued to that path, and less law related, but there's another story I have in the can for boring people at parties of my adventures. Once I graduated college and realized I don't want to move to LA or New York. So what do I do now? Anyway, but I've always had, because that was always sort of like in the background, what was Derek's interest at the time. I've always had this continuing interest in computer science, purely at an amateur level. I do not claim to be professional in any way, but it does, like, while I was at the First Court of Appeals as a staff attorney, at one point, like, we had sort of some software that rudimentarily kind of helped create our shell document for our opinions. And at one point, I was like, this is rather rudimentary, and I think I know just enough that I can improve this. So I actually spent some time at the court, like, improving the system that just kind of helped create the shell document. Not obviously everybody wrote their opinions, but every now and then, I think you can tie any job that I've had, and you can see the moments where it dips his foot back into the computer science and technology world. But again, only at an amateur level. So I've always kept abreast of many things as far as computer science go. And I have a rudimentary knowledge of really visual basic for those who are computer programmers. It doesn't go beyond that. But I've just always kind of kept in touch with those. So at any firm I've ever been, I've always been, including at the court, I've always been the unofficial IT guy. So they'll go to me first. If I can't find the answer, then they'll actually go to the IT guy that we pay money to do this stuff. And it was actually at the court, the guy, Eddie, who's great, he and I had a great relationship. And there were just things that he didn't know that I did. And there were things that I didn't know that he did. And so we would often refer each other to, I got salary as a staff attorney, but they didn't care as long as I got my work turned in. If I was also helping somebody figure out how to get Word to do what it's supposed to be doing, that sort of thing. So I've always had, at an amateur level, an interest in computer science and all that sort of stuff.
I want to know whether you have found your undergrad in theater to be useful as a lawyer, because you think some people think of law as sort of performance in its own way.
Right.
And I just wonder if there's some translation between what you did as an undergrad versus being a lawyer.
I just want to start by saying, before we started recording, I promised them I wouldn't cuss on the show. So I'm going to say emphatically yes. And that's it. I'll keep it. And so I have a background in acting as well, but my primary background in theater and also just RTF, or radio, television, film, for those who don't know, was playwriting and screenwriting. I studied both in undergrad. So people, when they saw I had a theater degree, thought that Derek is the guy that wants to be in front of the judge and arguing everything. I was like, no. Derek is not that guy. Derek is the one who runs to write your brief, because that's what I have experience in. But I will say, it's like, I am emphatically believe this. I mean, everybody has their own style and approach, but I really believe that the education I got in undergrad for storytelling and narrating has dramatically had an influence on my ability to write a brief. And I mean, everybody has their own thing that they bring to it. So it's not like I'm better than everybody else, but I think you can see, if you read everything that I've written that goes before the appellate courts, you can identify, oh, Derek has a background in drama, and hopefully that's a beneficial thing. I believe it is. But yeah, it very, very much influences how I write even to this day.
Let's kind of set the stage a little bit here. A theater reference. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. When we talk about AI, artificial intelligence? I mean, what are some kind of background understandings or definitions that'll help with that conversation?
And that's a good question. Let me start with, for the computer programmers that are listening to this, remember, I emphasize repeatedly that I'm amateur. So I know a lot of my definitions for an actual computer programmer are going to make their head spin.
No, these are for appellate lawyers. So exactly, you can say whatever you want to go and nobody's going to know the difference.
You're among friends.
I know, but I'm just saying, for any computer programmers, find your own podcast and listen to that.
That's right. Why are you here?
You're on the wrong place, man. For my just sort of layman's perspective, I mean, I think it helps to kind of start back. We're all sort of a similar age where, I mean, we can remember in the early 2000s that algorithm was like the term du jour for anything that was electronic, mm-hmm. right? If you had an algorithm, you were the bleep, right? So that was what algorithm means as far as computer science goes is a lot more detailed than what I can give you, but it's just sort of the way I'm using it here is just you have a very long and technical process to develop a system. It's a system within computer programming. And more often how you saw it, an algorithm was just sort of like in Google or in Facebook, is a sort of a sorting algorithm to decide what's to put up on top that's going to keep you engaged the longest, mm-hmm. that you're going to find more relevant, that you keep coming back to that website. So back in the early 2000s, if you said, and I had an algorithm, people were like, ooh, you're special. I want to go to your website. But really what that meant was just could be a wild variety of actual things as far as when you get down to the details. But now I think we have sort of artificial intelligence is like the term du jour for technology. And it's just as broad, actually probably broader, and has much harder to define. But for our purposes, let's just kind of say it's just how I personally define it. And I think you'll find some stuff like this roughly the same online, is a process that is done by a computer or whatever else you want to call it, that if it was done by a person, you would consider that to be a demonstration of intelligence. So it's not just like creating a list. It's not just sort of adding numbers unless they're really complex numbers, but it's just any sort of process that is sophisticated that if you saw a human doing it, describe that as intelligence, which is a vague definition, I know. But then really what my focus on in this paper that I've been doing, I think we're talking about here, is something more specific called generative AI. And again, that can mean many things, but it's just sort of a form of artificial intelligence that can create something new that did not exist before. And the more common examples are it like creates a piece of art that did not exist before. You could find similar things, but you didn't find this one thing. Or you can find a string of text or a story or whatever that you could not find before. And so that's what generative AI is supposed to do. And that's part of why it's considered artificial intelligence, to creating this prose or this artwork or whatever piece of music that we have previously ascribed to just human capacity and not didn't consider that to be part of what computers could do. Those are the basics that I think are going to lay the groundwork for what we need to go over today.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as court surety bond agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
You mentioned your paper, and before I let it get away from me, Jody shared a copy of it with me, and I have to admire the Philip K. Dick reference in the title. Yeah.
Thank you. Actually, but just so everybody knows the title, here, let me go to the top so I have it. It's Do Android Lawyers Dream of Electric Billable Hours? And as you've referenced, this is a Philip K. Dick reference to a short story that he's written called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Obviously, that was very intentional. It's a play off of that title. That short story then became Blade Runner. And so there was, mm-hmm. in my own way, an homage mm-hmm. towards Blade Runner, because I'm not the world's biggest sci-fi geek, but oh man, in front of Blade Runner, and just don't talk to me after that. I will get mad at you if you talk to me while Blade Runner is.
So, well, it's one of my favorite genres. And the only reason why I know, when I saw the title, right. I was like, oh, this is clever.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It was actually Jody's and mine. It's Christina Crozier, and she actually helped me along at certain stages of preparing this. She did the first presentation on it because I was going to be out of town, and I had to explain the meaning of the title to her so that if anybody asked, you would She wouldn't have this blank stare on her face. Like, I don't know what you're referring to. So anyway, but no, I was, but that's my creative side coming out, right? It was like, I had to find a way to wrap Philip K. Dick into this.
I love it.
All right. I'm going to preface this next question with, again, for appellate lawyers, not computer scientists, how generally does generative AI work? And I'm talking more like the Chat GPT than the DALL-E type.
Right. So let me just quickly describe those two things. It was like, both of those are run by OpenAI, which was kind of, I mean, there's other predecessors, but they've kind of been the, like, the big name right now is OpenAI. They've created DALL-E, which does artwork, and they've created ChatGPT, which does conversations or prose, whatever you want to call it. And the idea for the artwork for DALL-E, again, we won't focus on it, but it's like, you just give it a textual prompt, a text prompt, and say, draw me a picture of blank. And it will do that, right? And you can sort of refine that. So it's taking text prompts and then it's turning images into it. And it's quite amazing, honestly. It's really fascinating to see it work. But the counter side that OpenAI runs is ChatGPT. Pardon me, cut that out later, please. But there's a lot of other things that are similar to that. So in this conversation, when I refer to ChatGPT, I mean, there's Bard, there's Bing has something similar. I think it works off of, of ChatGPT. So there's a whole bunch of different competitors, but I'm just using ChatGPT as like a stand-in for all of them. Basically, the idea is, if I can tangent real quick, there's like the Turing test, and I think that kind of helps describe it.
I was going to get to that, but hey, if you want to drop it in here.
Let me jump into that. Yeah, because to me, that the two are related. So there's Alan Turing. I could also spend, well, I don't know that much about him, but I admire the man deeply. So I don't know if I could spend an entire CLE on him. But I would be willing to spend the time to learn to spend an entire CLE on him, letting anybody know who wants me to do that. But he, back in the, he did, was involved in World War II. He operated very heavily in the 50s as well. And he developed a theory in the 50s called, and he developed something called the imitation game. And the idea of the imitation game is you have someone who's the interrogator, is the term that we're going to use. And let's say you, dear listener, are the interrogator, and you will have, be receiving a communication. You won't be seeing either one, but you'll be receiving two communications, one from a computer and one from an actual person. And you can communicate however you want, ask them anything you want. You can say anything you want and get a response back and just have a conversation with them. And the idea is, can you identify from these just casual, open-ended conversations, which one is the human and which one is the computer? And that's what he identified as the imitation game. And his prediction was, and it's a lengthy prediction that involved numbers, so I won't read it out, was that by the turn of the century, that he thought computers would be advanced enough that they would be able to pass the Turing test like 70% of the time. And the conclusion that he drew from that is that that he expected around that same time that people would be able to say, to refer to computers as thinking in the normal sense of the word, and nobody would object to that description. And so that's sort of the reason I'm bringing it up is like, I think ChatGPT kind of fits into that. I mean, we know it's a computer, so we know the conceit is I'm talking to a computer, but it feels like you were talking to a person. And it's very easy to fall into the trap of kind of believing that you're talking to a person, and get more into that later on of what the implications of that are. But it can be anything. It can be, you can ask it a question, it'll give you an answer. You can ask it to sort of give a philosophical response to a philosophical question. You can ask it to write a cover letter for you. You can ask it to, it's very, very broad and honestly impressive in what it can do. But it's, as opposed to DALL-E, which is images, this is all sort of text-based. It's supposed, you give it a question and it is giving you a response back. That's the overview of it. You can, I guess, get into the details of what that means and what it's really doing if you want.
Well, people would have heard that phrase before, the imitation game, because it was, we, I knew it primarily from being a movie back going on 10 years ago now, where Turing was the main character, Benedict Cumberbatch. So if it sounds familiar, well, that's the reason why, because
And if you want to learn more about Alan Turing, that's a good movie to start with. I mean, it's dramatized, obviously, but it's a good way to start off to learn about him.
Sure.
Well, and one of the things you talk about in your paper is kind of a very simple example is predictive text just on your phone or in Google.
Yeah, and that's exactly. To me, that's a simpler way to look at it. Like if you were texting somebody and if you have your smartphone and it has that little bar above the text of like three ideas of what it thinks you want to say next. And sometimes it's the example that I gave in my paper is like, if you say, I'm going to make mac and cheese is going to be right there as one of the choices that you would do. if you put in like the board certified and appellate, and it's not going to know what to say after that, right? And so that is like a simplified version. It is basically the way your text prediction on your phone work is it's going to take just a sort of a fairly large database of information of things that's been written before. And it kind of compiles, all right, when people have written this amount of information before that, most of the time, the next word is going to be one of these three things. And so it's trying to do it. So the more common a phrase is, the more likely it's going to predict what the next phrase is. The less common it is, then the less likely it can predict what the next word you're going to use is going to be. And that is really a very simplified but accurate way to look at what ChatGPT is doing. ChatGPT is doing it on a much larger scale. And that, but that's what it's doing. And I want to emphasize this, and I'm sure we'll discuss this many times. It's doing a linguistic prediction of what this prompt that this person has given me, looking at this huge database of text that I have to review, what is going to be the most likely thing that is going to fit linguistically in response to what this person has said. And I think this might be one of your questions. I think it's worth jumping into now is just what that means, though. At least there's two things that that means that I think is important to understand. First of all, the information going out is good as the information coming in, right? So if there is bias in the information, there's going to be bias in its response. And so as you might imagine, this probably is not going to surprise too many of your listeners, but there's a lot of misinformation on the internet. I don't know if you guys knew that. Some came across that somewhere. Yeah. So if your primary source for information is what's available on the internet, and I actually can't say that their primary source is that, but I know a lot of it is, even if it's not primary. If your primary source of information is the internet and you're trying to draw conclusions based on that alone, you're going to have a lot of bias that is going to come out into responses that you give. The other very strong implication of this is that ChatGPT cannot know if what it is saying is true or false, because all that it is doing is looking at things that have been written in the past and trying to predict what to say in the moment. Whether any of those things are true or any things that it is saying is true, it just can't know. And this has led to what has come to be called a hallucination. And that's maybe another term that we need to go over is a hallucination. The shortest definition of a hallucination is something that would be considered a lie if a human were saying it. It's just not true. The reason it's called a hallucination is just because, again, ChatGPT doesn't know. It doesn't know it's quote unquote lying because it doesn't know what's real. It doesn't understand fact from fiction. And so that is the huge risk that we're going to go over a lot more today of, I guess we'll go over that in pieces, but that's the huge downside, in my opinion, using ChatGPT in the legal context. If you're just doing it for fun, why not? Go for it. It's fun. But it's a real liability in the legal context.
One other kind of background piece is when we talk about in a context outside of what people will think it is, an LLM or sort of the lock-in date. Can you kind of explain what those concepts are and how they impact what comes in?
LLM is a large language model, and that's what I'm referring to, is this like vast database of information that's coming in. And it's actually, I mean, I don't know a lot about how those things are structured, but I did read an article that was really interesting, and I don't want to miscite it, but I think it was in The Atlantic, but I could be wrong. But I actually learned it's just a lot of these things is they'll have, maybe this was also for DALL-E, but they just have these sort of low-grade workers in these kind of third world countries just drawing connections to things. And so like in, for pictures, which is again, DALL-E, they'll kind of describe the things that appear in that picture. And then that information is then used in part of their large, I don't know if that's language model, if that's still what they're calling it for DALL-E. Something similar is there's a lot of tagging going on by kind of low-wage workers across the world. I don't know the details of this, and I don't want to go over my skis because I just read an article. But I don't know. The other thing I have to confess, the other thing about something date, I can't say.
The lock-in date?
Lock-in date.
Todd, do you want to?
Well, ChatGPT, for example, the database has a cutoff where it can't access information existing after a certain date. I think it's September 21, I believe.
Something like that. I know it's been updated a couple of times, but there is a limitation to its learning.
Yeah.
Okay. So it can't give you the most recent things.
It'll acknowledge its own limitation.
Yeah, to some degree it will.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean,
you're not going to get the most up-to-date information asking ChatGPT questions with acknowledges the limitation. That's at least some disclosure. And after some recent events, it started saying, giving some more detailed disclaimers, could or couldn't do, I've noticed, but I wanted to ask a quick follow-up because, you know, we've been hearing for many years about this whole concept of big data. Does this really relate the LLM, the large language model, or is it related to that in any way? Or is it more, this is really focused on a database that the people who built ChatGPT have control over, use to generate Gen AI responses?
Right. Yeah.
I think things that fit into it.
It's a good question. I can't say that I know a lot about it, but my sense of it is that what we speak of when we're talking about big data is really sort of collection against us, right? Like getting our information and we are now part of the web and that sort of thing. And I mean, that's some to the degree that's brought into ChatGPT, because if you ask about sort of historical figures or popular people today, it's going to know who you're referring to in a lot of the circumstances. But I don't think it's sort of the big data in the sense that I think of when I'm thinking of, like, if I say something, have a conversation with a friend near an Alexa speaker, then all of a sudden I'm seeing ads for that thing 10 minutes later, that sort of thing. And that's the way I sort of envision it. I don't know how much those two interrelate, to be perfectly honest.
Well, let's kind of explore a little more a couple of the things that you talked about, the concept of bias. And in your paper, you give a specific example of a defamation lawsuit. If you want to kind of reference that, I think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. It's just fascinating to me. I'll just go on and describe it rather than just say how fascinated I am. So there is a guy by the name of Mark Walters. These events were quite recent within this year, but I forget the dates now. But Mark Walters is actually, from what I understand, a radio host in Georgia. And he's a fairly conservative guy. I don't know a lot about him, but his main job is to be a radio host in Georgia. Separate from that, there's a guy named Fred Real. Mr. Real, if you're listening to this and I'm saying your name wrong, I deeply apologize. He's a journalist and I don't know where he's based, but he was doing an investigation into a lawsuit in the Western District of Washington, which for the appellate lawyers, they all know what that means. So there was a complaint that was filed in this case in the Western District of Washington. He provided a link to that case to ChatGPT and then asked ChatGPT, hey, can you provide me a summary of what this complaint is? And so ChatGPT was more than happy to oblige and said that the suit was against Walters, our radio host in Georgia. And he said that Walters had worked for the Second Amendment organization, and he was at some point in the past had been the treasurer and CFO of that organization. And that in this lawsuit that ChatGPT had been asked to review, that the foundation was suing him for embezzling funds and manipulating financial records. The problem is that none of that is true. And these are all what we're referring to. All of it was what we're referring to as a hallucination. And so the lawsuit did not involve Walters at all. Walters has never worked for the Second Amendment Foundation organization. I forget what it is. I think I have it in two different places. It's one of those. But he never worked for the organization, and he's never been accused of embezzlement by anyone, let alone this organization. So the journalist informed Walters. And then Walters turned around and sued OpenAI. And honestly, I should have before this done some updating to see if there's been any activity on that. And I haven't. I think this is attorneys, not even just appellate attorneys. We could really sort of get into the ins and outs of that lawsuit, right? I mean, because I don't want to go too far astray, but it's like he sued OpenAI, which is the entity that runs ChatGPT. And I agree that's the correct entity to sue. But it wasn't really that entity that said that thing. They just created some software that said that thing. And so can you do defamation against the company? Because you have to have intent, right? And so how do you show intent for that company when this ChatGPT is just sort of spitting out random information? I mean, fascinating question. I really could just spend hours on my own just sort of tumbling that over in my head. And how do you show that there's the mental state? And then I think we all know this one is a fairly simple one that is like, what are your damages? The only thing that happened is Real saw it. It doesn't, from what we can tell, Real didn't believe it. And then he told Walters. So the damages are nothing if they exist at all, or limited if they exist at all. But that is, to me, is a sort of a symbol. I don't think there's going to anything can come of that lawsuit, but it creates that question of what sort of lawsuits are we going to see in the future that we just didn't dream would exist, right? But it's also relating to hallucinations. Again, if you know anything, if you've done your research on OpenAI, you know it can't tell fact from fiction. And so have you been defamed? If something, the way I said it in one of my presentations is, can a magic eight ball defame you? And if it, right? So if the magic eight ball can't defame you, can OpenAI, can ChatGPT? It's not much different. I mean, the ChatGPT is fancier, but I don't mean to offend anybody at OpenAI, but in my opinion, I consider ChatGPT to be this really interesting parlor game and not anything else. And so it's just, I don't know, should you be allowed to trust it in order to be defamed by it is the kind of the point that I would drive home.
This is the kind of thing, though, because this is such a still novel area.
Right.
Yes. You're going to have test cases, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it seems like to me, this has just got test case written all over.
Yeah, doomed to fail, but an interesting test case. But it just, again, it was like, what sort of things are we going to see in the future that just we didn't dream of today, right?
Yeah.
Like my wildest dream of a lawsuit in the future is not going to be able to encompass what is going to come down the road, probably sooner than later. But this is sort of a sign of things to come of what are we facing? But yeah.
It's very interesting. When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today. So one of the things that might be worth covering right now, just for folks who are just learning about ChatGPT and getting to know what it actually does, I know it has limitations on its ability to reach onto the internet to gather information. And so you said that what was provided here, basically a link to the actual lawsuit.
Yeah. And the thing is, I don't know. I don't claim to in any way know the inner workings of ChatGPT or how OpenAI created the software. But I honestly question, the guy provided a link, but I would seriously doubt that ChatGPT was actually able to open that link and review it. It just like it was told to give a summary of a case. And so it just started making stuff up. Mm-hmm. So my guess is just a guess. It had no idea the contents of that link. It just started to try to provide a response that would fit linguistically in what it had been given to do.
Right.
Go ahead, Todd.
I'm still just kind of thinking, it's like, just in my own experience using ChatGPT, wouldn't it be more beneficial if it could actually go and analyze the data behind a link to have the capability? Maybe this is not capable in this model, but maybe it would not have hallucinated had it been able to access the information in the link. Or like there are other models like Claude, for example, that make it pretty simple. You can essentially upload a PDF into the interface and it'll actually examine the document itself.
So right.
This thing could have prevented if a different interface had been used potentially. Right. But
and it's possible OpenAI can. It just from its response, I'm sort of assuming it, I don't think it could read a single thing off of that document. And it would also, again, to be able to sort of compare to give a better response, it would also need to have other complaints and litigation type documents in its database. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I don't know, but that would have to be part of its database as well to compare it against.
I'm showing my own ignorance of how the technology works. And
I don't claim to know it very well. I'm just, you know, on a certain level, I've gotten to understand just sort of, I know the information that goes in. I know the information that comes out. I don't claim to know in between that black box.
Right.
Well, and that I think is one of the important takeaways here is if you need to have some level of technical competence about what its abilities aren't, at a basic level before you really start to use it beyond just sort of having fun and playing around with it.
Right.
For this exact reason, because there are a lot of pitfalls on the discussion of sort of future implications here. So are we all going to be out of work in a few years thanks to AI and ChatGPT?
Thanks for setting me up on that one. So I did actually some research on this because I thought actually this, I don't think this is really a part of the original scope that I had, but I knew that as soon as I start going down this road, people are going to say, wait, is ChatGPT going to take away my job? And the short answer is no. And I could go lengthy, but I'll try to keep this short. I am not an economist. I don't claim to be an economist. I have a background in computer science and I have a background in theater. Economy has never fit into either of those two, which won't surprise you. But I did try to do some research on this because I've heard some sort of stuff on this idea before. And there is sort of this broad consensus among economists. It's like technology doesn't really take away jobs, but what they're saying, I think it's important to understand exactly what they mean when they say it. Because then I give say, and then my paper is like, I actually did some research because I was curious and just being whimsical. I did some research and I don't know what point, but before alarm clocks were these things that you could go to the store and buy, if you needed to wake up at a certain time, there was someone called, and I think a knocker, and they would go by and they had this long pole and they would knock on your window at a certain time. And that person was your alarm clock. And they would go around the town knocking on people's windows at the designated time because alarm clocks weren't invented then. I think we can all agree those jobs have been replaced. But what the economists are saying is that on net, if technology might take away a portion of a job more often than it eliminates a job altogether, and even when it does that, it creates more jobs that are needed to interface with that technology. And so net, any sort of technological advance is also met with an increased demand for the human populace to perform some sort of job. And so the question is like, are there going to be aspects of our jobs as attorneys in the future that we are doing as humans today that are going to be done by computers? The answer is probably yes. Aspects of our job will probably be taken over. But we already know that's true, right? We already go to Westlaw or LexisNexis rather than pulling the books off of our shelves, which is how you used to do it a long time ago. So
thank goodness, by the way.
Oh, God, I am not complaining. All the people are like, back in the time, we used books. I'm like, I am not missing that. So I welcome that in that regard. But it was like, it's whether it's going to take away your job, no. There will still be first-year associates in the future. There will still be fifth-year associates. It's just what that job looks like will be different, but it won't eliminate the need for lawyers in that sense. I expect it will actually cause it to grow based on trends that we've seen in the past. And I don't see any reason why it shouldn't happen here. Again, not an economist, but from what I've seen. But there is actually, I don't know if you have this as a question. There's one sort of story that I put in the paper that it just sort of confounded me that I'd like to go in on this topic. Just because the technology like ChatGPT won't take away your job doesn't mean people won't try, because we already have a documentation of that. It's quite shocking to me. There was a case where there's a group that runs a suicide hotline. And I think it deals, if my memory serves, it deals specifically with people who have weight issues. And they've operated the suicide hotline with a select group of people that have experience in dealing with this specific type of suicide prevention. Obviously, very serious issue, very important issue. And during COVID, it probably will not surprise anyone to hear that the hotline was ringing more often than it had been before. And it was putting huge demands on the staff. And this is the part that I just flabbergasted by, is that the organization who ran it were not showing much sympathy for its own staff that were having to run this hotline. And I believe, if I remember right, is that they were trying to organize. And during this time, around the time that this was going on, they had hired this software company to help them develop a software that was supposed to work alongside the people that did the hotline to give prompts of here's what you can say here and that sort of thing to help the people in dealing with the people they're responding to on the hotline. And what they decided to do when the employees started to try to organize because they were being overworked was they fired all the employees and said, this software that we have paid for, this sort of ChatGPT-ish generative AI software that we have paid for, is now going to be our hotline. And the software company that created the software said, this is not what it was designed for. So they fired everybody, and that went exactly as well as you would think it would. Yeah, if you're contemplating suicide and you're trying to talk to somebody that can relate to you, the last thing you want to do is talk to a computer that's going to do predictive text to try to respond to whatever your concerns are. And that went down in flames just like it should have. So hopefully that's going to be a good enough warning that this doesn't become a common occurrence where people are like, I could just fire everybody. But people will try it. I expect that will happen. But I think those are going to be bumbling failures, as they already have been shown to be.
Well, in the context of legal practice particular, there's a number of ethical issues that kind of come out of this.
That's
a totally different overlay. Yeah. Maybe we can kind of talk about those a little bit, particularly the Mata case. I know spend an entire episode, but
we really could. But let's talk about that, but we can then get into the ethical implications that kind of follow from that case, because it's a good highlight of these issues. Well, I'm going to give a little caveat, but I'll wait a little bit because I feel a little bit bad for the attorneys that got slapped in this one. But we have a guy named Roberto Mata, and in 2019, he was on a flight, an international flight, and that matters, from El Salvador to New York. And Mata alleges in a lawsuit that came later that during the flight, an employee of the airline, which is Avianca, struck him in the knee with a metal serving cart, and he suffered injuries. And I don't know the severity. I've never tried to understand exactly how badly he was hurt. But he was hurt apparently badly enough that he decided he needed representation. Before this lawsuit happens, in 2020, Avianca, the airline, files for bankruptcy. And while the bankruptcy is pending, Mata files suit. And all of our lawyers who are listening know what that means. The computer scientists, well, again, you're on the wrong show. The bankruptcy is pending. Mata files suit after Mata realizes, or his attorneys realize, that the bankruptcy is pending. This is in New York, so they file what is called a stipulation to dismiss without prejudice. And we can all take a really good guess at what that means, even if we don't practice in New York. And then if the bankruptcy concludes later, I don't know exactly when it concluded, but then Mata refiled suit in early 2022. And just as a reminder, this injury occurred in 2019, and more than 2 years have passed. So he files suit in state court. Avianca, the airline, removes to federal court and then moves to dismiss the suit, arguing they raise a number of things, but they do a 12b6. And they say one of their arguments is the statute of limitations for international flights was 2 years. And so he has filed the suit too late. Mata's attorneys file a response to the motion, and they cite cases holding the bankruptcy tolls the statute of limitations in question. And again, I said this was an international flight. There is the Montreal Convention, I believe, is the convention that controls the law for international flights and the limitations period for such claims. And under the Montreal Convention, it's 2 years. And so he has cited authorities to say, well, the bankruptcy has told that, and so I still get to file suit in 2022. Avianca's attorneys file a reply. In the reply, they inform the court that they could not locate any of the relevant cases cited by Mata. And then the court, on its own accord after this, probably had looked into it on its own, and issues an order requiring Mata to produce 10 of the opinions cited within its response to the 12b6. And this is really, I mean, things are already bad at this point. We already kind of see where this is going, and many of our listeners probably already know where this is going. But this is really where things start to go off the rails, because at this point, Mata's counsel does not come clean. And what they do is they file an affidavit and they attach quote unquote excerpts. If you go and look up the case and you read these excerpts, you're like, this is not what a legal opinion looks like. Attached to the document, it was these quote unquote excerpts of eight of the 10 cases they were supposed to produce. And their explanation for why they've only provided experts is it's because that was only what was made available by online database. That's a quote. Only what was made available by online database. And the attorney says in his affidavit that one of the 10 cases could not be found at all. And then he says this one makes me laugh. Another one was not included because, quote, it is an unpublished opinion. And I think every appellate attorney is going to get a chuckle out of just, I can't find it because it's unpublished. That's not a really good defense for why you can't find an opinion. So this will surprise no one. The court then issues a show cause hearing. And all of our appellate attorneys know if you are invited to a show cause hearings, bad things have happened. This is not you don't call your mom up and say, hey, mom, I got invited to a show cause hearing. So the court says in the show cause order, 6 of the submitted cases appear to be bogus judicial decisions with bogus quotes and bogus internal citations. Not good, by the way. And then after that, Mata's counsel files another affidavit. And this is the one, it's a gut punch when you read it, because Mata's counsel then in that affidavit says, you know what? Actually, I didn't do any of the research or drafting that I signed my name to. And instead, that was done by another attorney in the firm. Again, not something you want to call up mom and say you did, right? So that's bad. But this time, this other attorney then files his own affidavit. Let me put in the caveat real quick, because I'm going to read it, but it's just like, both of these attorneys, right? So it's clearly two attorneys that were involved in this. Both of these attorneys have been drugged through the mud. And I'm deservedly or not deservedly, I'm not going to get into here, but their reputation has taken a hit. And this is not the first place this has been discussed. This has been in legal communities. This has spread quite rapidly. I empathize for them. I am not trying to mock them, but this is also, unfortunately for them, a very good learning point for every other attorney involved. So I have some joviality in my voice, but I also have a good deal of empathy for these attorneys and the harm to the reputation that they have suffered. And I just hope that I never find myself in this situation myself. I said myself twice. You can strike one of those later when you edit. So the second attorney who has now said, yeah, this was me all along, in his affidavit, he says, as the use of generative artificial intelligence has evolved with law firms, your affiant consulted the artificial intelligence website ChatGPT in order to supplement the legal research performed. And then I'll read another portion that he said, but I want to pause. Actually, because I was so curious about this case, I read more. I don't know. Somehow I was able to read parts of the transcript. I think maybe the entire transcript was in the record. I forget, of the hearing for the show cause. And at that hearing, the guy said that when he said supplement the legal research, really what he meant was all of the legal research. So that was another thing he got dinged for, because he's trying to sort of diminish what he had done in his affidavit, because he had gone on to, I think, Fastcase or one of those sort of databases to do the research, found nothing, and then went to ChatGPT. So he did do some research, but he just found nothing. Went to ChatGPT. ChatGPT says, oh yeah, here are all these cases. And he said, good enough for me. And then quoted them in the response. So it wasn't supplement. It was all. The attorney obtained in the affidavit, he says, he obtained the questions from ChatGPT, quote, which also provided its legal source and assured the reliability of its content. So he relied, because ChatGPT was like, cool, man, this is legit. He was like, good enough for me, I'm done. Again, I don't want to mock too much, but I think we all know that you cannot stop there. And anybody who's listening to this podcast and didn't know about ChatGPT beforehand, you now know you definitely cannot stop there. And that's where he got harmed. So 10 cases cited on the show cause hearing, none of the 10 cases exist. The holdings were made up. The citations within the holdings were made up. And this is what I find kind of interesting. The judges identified in these fake opinions are real judges. And so that's going to, we can tie into that later on, because that has its own problems. To wrap that up, we can kind of go more into, well, actually, do you want me to pause, or do you want me to kind of go into what the court did in response?
Yeah, okay. Let's finish the story.
So the court sanctions these guys, which probably surprises no one. And it talks about the harm in citing fake authority. And one of them is waste time of opposing counsel in the court. True. It deprives the client of persuasive argument. I mean, the court gives a lot of examples, but to me, that's like the big asterisk one, right? Like, you have harmed your client by doing this. And the other thing, though, is I said asterisk on the it cited real judges, as the court was like, this can harm the reputation of judges and the party cited within the fake opinion. Because again, this it identified actual judges. And I don't know exactly, I couldn't tell you which one, but let's say, for example, like it would say it was an 11th Circuit opinion, but one of the judges cited it as being on the panel was, say, from the 6th Circuit. I don't know if that's literally true, but that should have been, if you know the judges, which most of us honestly don't know, I don't know that all the federal judges. So I don't know if that would have been a red marker for me. It was like, oh, this isn't correct. But this sort of stuff does come to light, there is that potential that it can harm the judges, is that they're being associated with things that are not their opinions and actually are not the law, and could be, if taken as true, could end up hurting the opinion of the judges and the parties involved. And the other court also mentioned that it promotes cynicism in the judicial system. Again, not wrong. And so the court ultimately, as I said, sanctioned the guys. I don't exactly know. But one of the things, just to wrap up, again, just sort of the real harms here, one of the things the court emphasized is at no point, even up till the point that the order was issued awarding sanctions, did you withdraw your response. Even though finally they were like, yeah, this came from ChatGPT, they never actually asked the court to withdraw or modify or anything the response. And that really bothered the court. And I think first of all, don't do this, right? But if you get stuck in a situation like this, come clean as quickly as you can. And if you have cited false authority, do more than saying, oops, my bad. You have to say, court, I can no longer rely on this, and I cannot represent this to be something advancing my position or my client's position, and please allow me to withdraw it. So bear both of those things in mind. It's not just saying, oops, my bad is not enough. You also have to say, try to withdraw what you have filed that bears this false information. So there's also Judge Starr in Northern District of Texas did some stuff right around this time. You want me to jump into that? And then we can kind of get into the ethics of it.
No, that was one of the places I wanted to go, was kind of talk about what courts have done in light of some of these issues.
Right. And maybe others have happened, but this is what I found interesting. This was Judge Starr, who's in the Northern District of Texas, and this suit, as I mentioned, took place in New York. So this is a different area. He came out with some new orders in May of 2023, and this was before the court had come out with its sanction order, but after all of this stuff had come to light. And so there's a lot of supposition, and I'm in the camp that is supposing this, is that Judge Brent Starr issued these new rules in response to this Mata case. But I don't know that to be true. But he's created sort of a new local rule for appearing in his court, and it says all attorneys and pro se litigants appearing before the court together, when they appear, must file on the docket a certificate attesting that no portion of anything they file will be drafted by generative AI, which is ChatGPT, et cetera, or that any language drafted by generative artificial intelligence will be checked for accuracy. And this is, let me try to emphasize this phrase, by using print reporters or traditional legal databases, and that those things are checked against that by a human being. So you have to say at the beginning of the litigation, you're going to do one or the other, never use it, or you will do your double checking that on anything drafted by these using a traditional legal database, and a human has to do that double checking. So this, he actually gets into some of the ethics. And I disagree with nothing of what he says. He says they can be powerful, but legal briefing is not one of its uses that should be applied. And he mentions that these platforms are used both hallucinations and bias. And he says on the point of hallucination, they make stuff up, even quotes and citations, which again, reflect back to the Mata case. And then he focuses on bias or reliability. And he says, attorneys swear an oath to set aside their personal prejudices and biases and beliefs and try and uphold the judicial system, right? That we have taken an oath, an ethical responsibility, not just represent our client, but also the system at large. And he says these computers are unbound. They don't have a sense of duty or honor or justice. They aren't bound by any ethical restraints, and they don't really know how to advance the ethical or the rule of law or the ethics involved in the legal process. And so they can't be relied on for that process. But to me, is what, because I emphasized twice, as he said in his restriction, is like, you can't use this unless you've compared it against a traditional legal database. And I think for all of us who practice, we think of Westlaw and LexisNexis as the primary examples of that. But what I've shown in my presentations, really what concerns me is if you go to Westlaw, or if you go to LexisNexis, they are promoting, we've got generative AI. They are saying it in full force. And I have LexisNexis for my practice, and multiple times it has said, hey, Derek, do you want to try your generative AI stuff? We've got it over here. And each time I'm like hitting that button, like, no. And I wish they had a button that said, no, don't ever ask me again, because it's just, I won't touch it. And so the thing is, maybe it's not that bad. I'm just too scared of it. I don't trust it. Generative AI, I mean, maybe they're just using that as, again, that's the hot term to be using today. So back in the early 2000s, if they said, we have an algorithm, everybody was excited right. about that. I think they're trying to right. tie into that, right? And so they're like, we have generative AI. I think they're tied into that. And I don't know how strong or weak it is. I don't really know what it does. But I keep coming back to Judge Starr's order. If I use that on Westlaw, or if I use that on LexisNexis, have I complied with or have I violated his order? So I understand the spirit of his order. I understand all of the implications behind what he's saying ethically of why this order exists. But I think even if we are not at that train wreck now, that order is heading towards a train wreck, because generative AI, whether we want to or not, is going to become more a part of our lives every day. And so whether you have violated or stuck with that order is going to be, in my opinion, much, much harder to determine in the future than right now. So that's a lot of the ethics related to it, but it's also just, if more orders like this come down, am I complying with it or am I not? Mm-hmm. Am I allowed to use generative AI with less law or am I not? So clarification is probably going to be in order very soon.
I see a difference between Lexis and Westlaw are offering with Gen AI in terms of the phrasing of legal research terms and summaries of searches and things that I know are currently available and the representation of what a case says. There's definitely a line there that you can draw between, mm-hmm. well, it's Gen AI is altering the text of a case or is hallucinating an entire citation and authority. Mm-hmm. Definitely not the same thing. So I think there's room. These orders are interesting. I know Judge Starr is not the only one to mm-hmm. issue orders like this. There's some people that say, well, this really isn't necessary because we're all bound by the general rules of ethics right. anyway.
I tend to fall in that camp, but yeah.
I tend to fall in that camp too, but that said, it's a good idea to shine some light on the issue.
Right, right.
So maybe an order like this won't be necessary in the future when we all kind of figure out, oh yeah, it's kind of like when we first all mm-hmm. got the internet or email.
Right, exactly.
And
right.
you know, everybody was worried about breaching privilege by sending emails and things like mm-hmm. that. So I think a careful lawyer, I understand the dilemma. It's just like the test case you know, we spoke about. Mm-hmm. And Mata right. is its own test case in a little different way,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. This is like the Titanic for the legal world with ChatGPT.
But the other thing, the other side of the coin to this that I have really not heard discussed anywhere that I can think mm-hmm. of is how do you balance this emerging technology with the lawyer's duty of technological competence? Mm-hmm. Because you know, we're also told in our ethics rules, we've got a duty to our clients to be able to use technologically, we have a duty to our clients to use technology competently.
Right.
And we have now this resource that's available to us that can potentially help us do our jobs more efficiently. Yet to be seen how that is all going to mm-hmm. pan out.
Right.
So that I would flag that as another emerging issue that we really got to try to get a handle right. on.
You know, in the I mean, industry. I actually, for the moment, I have my own Derek Bauman's asterisk, take it for what it's worth, own theory of how you could use ChatGPT and other things similar to it. And the examples that I've given is you have to be the guardrails when using ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. So you can use ChatGPT when you are asking questions where you already know the law, where you have already done your research. But you, what it can be beneficial for is, well, then why would you use it, right? But what it can be beneficial for is sort of like spitballing. It's just like, okay, I'm trying to think of the best legal arguments I can make concerning X. And you've done your research, you know what the law is on that area. And so you can go into ChatGPT and say, hey, what are three good arguments for why X should be the policy under Texas law? And if you've done your research and it starts spitting stuff out and one of them is just complete nonsense, well, then you've done it and you know it and you can identify that and you can move that one away. But it's possible that when you're using ChatGPT, you're like, oh, I didn't think of that before. At least maybe, or it could be something else similar to, I don't think this is right, but now that it's saying that, I haven't considered this other possibility. So it could help you to think of things in a new light, but you have to be the referee. You have to put right. the guardrails up and know when it's feeding you nonsense and know when it's not. Mm-hmm. So for spitballing, yeah. The other example I will give is, I think none of our audience, except for the computer scientists, are going to find this helpful is, I don't mean to aggrandize the appellate lawyers, but we're an audience, so they will all smile if I do. We are all particularly good at writing, right? So I do mm-hmm. not consider ChatGPT to be a better writer than me. I consider it to be much worse than I am. But I know a lot of people who, they are excellent lawyers, but writing is not their skill. And so if you are a good lawyer and you know the law and you've done this other stuff, but you just aren't good at drafting, then you can go in and use ChatGPT to help you sort of begin that process. But if you do that, let me add one more red flag for you, because if you do some research on OpenAI's frequently asked questions portion of their website, one of the questions is, will you use the information I provide? And they're like, yeah, we use it for training purposes and show it to our employees. We reserve the right to anything you use. We reserve the right to use it for training purposes and show it to our employees. And if another question is, can I delete my prior conversations? The answer is no. And so you cannot ethically put client information into ChatGPT mm-hmm. without breaching your client confidentiality requirements. So that limits how you can use ChatGPT as a drafting tool. But that's actually kind of going back to what Judge Starr said. It was like, he says these platforms are very useful, but Legal Briefing is not one of them. That's one of the things where he and I disagree. I think Legal Briefing is one of them. It's legal research that is not one of them. But you still can't get around that ethical problem. So you still have to kind of feed it sort of, here's the law, help me hit state for the standard of review. Help me say the just general applicable law to this topic, and it can help you do that. And as long as you know when it's feeding you crap, then you can mm-hmm. use it. Again, and I'll wrap it up, but you have to be the referee. You have to know when it's gone off the rails.
Well, and I think to Todd's point, part of the technological competence duty is understanding its limitations, because that's right, exactly. important. It doesn't mean you exactly. have to use it. It means you have to understand how to use it responsibly. As it appears, right. I mean, it seems like from everything I've heard about the Mata case that it really was a sort of unintentional error up front, then just snowballed and compounded.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah, right. That's exactly what it was. And the thing is, honestly, I think the biggest hurdle we face is really going to be, we're going to start getting those calls where from a client is, well, I was talking to ChatGPT and ChatGPT tells me I have a great case. You know that
problem, right? Oh, absolutely.
That's like the next thing to the next advancement past the Google exactly. School of Law.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's exactly right. Well, I plugged what happened in ChatGPT, and ChatGPT has assured me I can win my case and my damages mm-hmm. are this. So that's the other part is going to be like, oh God, to be aware so I can talk to my client, so I can explain to my client the limitations of this. And just because ChatGPT has told you you have a great case does not mean, in fact, you have one. Mm-hmm. That also ties into the competence. You have to know where its limitations are so you can talk your clients down off of this sort of ivory tower that they've built for themselves for what their case is going to be able to do.
It sure seems like there's going to be a need for many, many ethics CLE presentations on yep. this topic. We're just scratching the surface. To your point earlier, Derek, we are really just scratching the surface on this. And so this is super fascinating. You can make the case, I suppose, that one could comply with their duty of technological competence right now by saying the use case for it is not settled enough
right.
currently right. to be able to use it effectively and ethically. But that's something I guess will be fleshed out later, because I don't think that will be the case for very long.
Mm-hmm. We'll see. I mean, I'm not a computer scientist, but I have read an article. I don't want to overemphasize this, by a computer scientist saying there's no way around this. There's no solution for this. But we've said that about technology in the past, and then somebody finds a solution. So maybe there is a way to sort of feed into these ChatGPT-like programs something that will give akin to an understanding of reality mm-hmm. that could help sort of temper this problem. So if that problem is solved, then maybe we can have more caution in our use of it. But it's also at that point, then we're like, oh crap, can it take my job? So mm-hmm. we'll be measured in our response whenever that should occur.
Well, and you have the commercial incentives for companies like Westlaw and LexisNexis to find a way to use it efficient for attorneys. So, I mean, there is a market right. pressure that's going to influence yeah. that as well.
It's and always going to be there, and it's going to become more of our part of our lives. Yeah. And mm-hmm. we need to get ready for that.
And to that point, and as we get close to wrapping up, we as lawyers, we speak about Westlaw and Lexis with this, I wouldn't call it reverence exactly, but we know what that product is.
Yeah,
exactly. We know what their databases generally consist of.
Right.
And so right. to the extent that those, call them what they are, they're vendors to law firms. Mm-hmm. To mm-hmm. the extent that those vendors are offering a product, you have some sort of built-in assurance about the quality of that product
right.
To some degree.
Exactly.
And you know that it's been vetted. You know that there's right. millions of dollars being spent advancing this stuff, because it's just going to be, we've already acknowledged, it's going to be transformative in some way. Right. We don't know. We can't really predict exactly what it's going to look like, what law practice is going to look like specifically in 10 years or 20 years. Mm-hmm. But so I would just throw out there that
to the extent that people are inclined to do this, I think you can talk to your Westlaw rep or your Lexis rep, and I think you can probably comfortably use those products in your law practice. I don't think you're going to find yourself at the wrong end of a sanctions order or a show cause order like what happened here by relying on those authorities. But beyond that, it's sort of anybody's guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A little bit of the Wild West.
If you do that and you appear before Judge Starr, I would encourage you to call the court and say, hey, am I allowed to do this? Because I'm just super nervous about those things. But it wouldn't hurt you to call the court and say, hey, am I running afoul by using this?
I think that's good advice for all lawyers. Sure. Is you check the local rules on this sort of stuff because they are beginning to pop up out there.
Right.
Yeah. Which is something that 5 years ago we wouldn't know about.
Yeah, that's there's going to be fits and starts in it. So maybe one order, mm-hmm. and I'm not saying Judge Starr's does, but maybe one order overreaches and but eventually you kind of figure out here's the mm-hmm. best way to formulate this. So we're still in that early stages where even the judges are trying to figure this out too, and where's the right balance. And so we just have to be careful on all sides how to proceed with that.
Well, I think that's a great point for, we can wrap up the substantive discussion, but Derek, I know you're aware that one of our traditions on our show here is to ask our guests for a tip or a war story as sort of a parting thought. Do you have something you'd like to share with us?
Well, I do. I have to learn how to keep this short because this is another one in the can that I bother people with at parties. But this one, they start to walk away if I go too long. I want to try to tell the story as briefly as I can, and then I'll give you my advice. Because I was just at the Court of Appeals, as I mentioned, for many times, and I've read a lot of briefs. And I don't mean to say this too cruelly, but I read a lot of briefs and found myself thinking a lot of times, wow, that's a crappy brief. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how, it's really the why. Why is this brief so bad? And what I noticed is, and then I'll wrap it up, is like I had interns who would come and they're in law school. They had this starry idea of especially what appellate law is. So they come to the Court of Appeals to intern and they have this sort of very romantic idea of what they're going to be encountering. And then I give them some briefs and they're like, oh my God, these briefs are terrible. And I was like, I know they are. But then I would say, well, now do your best research and do your look at the record and you tell me what you think the answer should be. And they would write up something for me. And again, not meaning to be mean, but the number of times I'd go, wow, this is not that good. And it got me onto this point. And I can go on forever, but I will wrap it up here. My theory that I have developed over time, because I spend way too much time thinking about this, is that every writer, no matter how good you are, you can be the best writer around, but by the time you have done all the research and understanding the law and all the research and understanding the facts and all of the analysis to figure out how to put that all together, by the time you've spent all of that time putting it all together, so you have in your mind the brief you want to write, it is so obvious to you that you forget what the person who does not mm-hmm. have this information mm-hmm. sees. And so what you are writing makes sense because you are entrenched in it. And of course, this makes sense because it's all in your mind right there. But it does not make sense to someone who does not have all of that information in their mind. And what I would encounter a lot when I did really not good briefs is once I did the research of the law and once I did the understanding of the record, and I went back to that brief and be like, oh, that's what they're talking about. And so I think that's what has been sort of the support for my theory. And it remains a theory. But the advice I give to everybody related to this theory, if they're still standing there and haven't walked away, is when you have written something, it of course it's going to make sense to you. And you cannot see the forest for the trees because you have spent so much time understanding mm-hmm. all this. So you serve yourself massively, and you sue your client massively if you find someone in your office who has no involvement in the case. You don't take it to the partner that's been working on this case alongside with you the entire time. You go to someone who has no involvement in the case, and I'm sort of joking, but I'm not joking. Find someone that really doesn't like you that much. Mm-hmm. And if you give it to them and they read it and they go, yeah, that makes sense, then you know it makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. If you send it to your friend, you've been best buddies since law school, of course, they're like, oh, you did great, I'm so proud of you. But they're not going to give you that objectivity, right? Find someone that really doesn't care about you and is annoyed when you walk up to their door. And that person is going to give you the best advice of, this made zero sense to me. I don't know why this is in here. This and this is missing something right here. You got to fill that in. And that, and then when someone says that to you, you're like, oh, right. So you have to learn how to be the person that knows everything and then somehow forget it in order to write that brief. That to me, and I've probably gone on too long, But that is my advice to everyone, is you have to learn that skill. And it is such a hard skill to learn.
That's a absolutely great tip. Right. Thank you.
As we're closing here, I guess it's time that we finally let the cat out of the bag. Derek Bauman is not actually a real person. He is an open AI platform designed to be like a lawyer. And this entire episode has just passed the Turing test. So congratulations to us.
Oh, that's amazing. That's perfect. I love that.
I have nothing to say in response to that, other than that's great.
You got me.
We really do appreciate it. Thanks for coming on and sharing the benefit of your experience and research. And we will look forward to following this topic far into the future, no doubt about it.
Yeah, this is our lives from now on. But thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed all of this.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.